Hey, Tacoma. What's up? John Doherty here for Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully and sometimes even optimistically. Today, we're talking with Thor Kallestad, who is a co-founder and the CEO of the Mino Carbon Corp. He has a background in environmental consulting, oil and gas, and mining. Mr. Kallestad believes most profitable future economic activities will be focused on operations that restore the environment, as opposed to operations of the last 150 years or so, like fossil fuel extraction, that degrade the environment. Mino Carbon is a startup with the goal of converting biowaste such as slash from tree farms into biochar. It's a local Puget Sound startup. Full disclosure, until I was a guest on a recent webinar, I had no idea what biochar was and never even heard of it. So what is it? And could it be a low-tech way of reducing world carbon emissions? Well, let's listen to my conversation with Thor and find out. We're really pleased to have Thor Kallestad. He's the CEO of Mino Carbon with us today. Thor, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Cool. So let's start right off a little bit. Who you are, who's Mino Corporation, and why should we care?
Yeah, no, good deal. So, name's Thor Kallestad, co-founder of the Mino Carbon Corporation. We're based on Bainbridge Island, right outside of Seattle. We're a startup, about 18 months old. My co-founder is a gentleman by the name of Tom Kasten. He's a real grandee in the carbon removal space, been doing cogeneration projects for a lot of years. He's the one that turned me onto this idea, and then we went out and recruited a team for it. But what we're doing with the company, we're focused entirely on climate change, trying to draw down as much carbon as we can, as fast as we can. What's unique about us is we want to do really big projects. We want to do big capital efficient projects that matter, that can really move the needle for the world. We realize that a few big projects from us is still a drop in the bucket to the larger problem, but there's a lot of room to run and put new facilities in to do this. And we can hopefully inspire a lot of other people to do it. You know, happy to talk more about the technical part of what we're doing along the way also, but climate change is our mission, solving it.
Sure. So I'm assuming that your corporation's a for-profit corporation.
It is. Yes. We think that's a key part of, we don't think the problem of climate change will ever be solved if there's not a profit to be made doing it.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting piece. I think it may be a super interesting piece because I think typically we think about, the for-profit corporations view steps to address climate change as more of a problem than a possible profit center.
It is. We've got a different view of that, though. I mean, I know there's the joke that the four most painful words in the English language are this time is different, but we really think this time it is different. With emissions and carbon, we think that public opinion has shifted on this issue. People acknowledge we cannot continue to spew unfettered into the atmosphere, and there will be prices on carbon, and there will be mandates, regulations, market incentives, et cetera, to be able to create economic growth and jobs without the emissions. That's kind of the key part of it that we're really focused on.
Gotcha. So clearly your vision is that you can take steps to address climate change, fossil fuel emissions primarily, and others. Well, agriculture is a big chunk of your piece too. I understand that. And that you can do that profitably. So before we talk more about that aspect of it, what is biochar anyway?
Yeah, great. So our business, in a nutshell, what we're going to be doing is building carbon removal facilities, and these make biochar. What we'll be doing is taking forest product waste, basically these slash piles, limbs and such that you see from logging operations on the side of the roads, sawdust, etc., the waste products that come out of the industry. We use this as a feedstock, and you run them through a pyrolysis chamber. Pyrolysis is high heat and a lack of oxygen. That lack of oxygen is what keeps CO2 emissions down. The high heat is what turns those wood products into biochar. And biochar is basically pure carbon. You know, you're very close to it. That's sequestered for thousands of years. It's a very stable form of carbon. So you essentially, the carbon that was in that wood becomes biochar, and then it gets back in the soil where it helps with water retention, soil productivity, all sorts of other benefits to it. And the other interesting thing about it is the second product that we make is there's waste heat, pyrolysis gas that is given off in the process of making biochar. And from that, we'll be making carbon negative electricity. So electricity sold to the grid and then biochar are the two main products that we're making. Each of those have a carbon attribute that I can talk more about that we're monetizing in the business. But you know, using forest product waste to make biochar and clean power.
Well, it's certainly an intriguing idea. And so I'm learning a lot here. It's not something that I really knew anything about until I saw a webinar here a month or so ago. You appeared briefly and talked a little bit about biochar. So how does the balance work between energy in and energy out when you're making biochar?
Yeah, so roughly if you have, I'll just say we got 100 units of wood coming in to the facility. And of that wood, roughly 50 of those units are carbon. Wood's basically half carbon. Of that half carbon, of those 50 units, essentially 25 become biochar. And the other 25 units of that carbon become the heat that generates the electricity. So half of the carbon in an incoming feedstock gets sequestered as biochar, and then the other half of it goes to generate the electricity.
So if I understand correctly then, so you're actually creating the biochar with the carbon that's actually in your raw material?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So that results in an emission then?
It does. It does. We emit CO2 up the stack and generating the electricity. Of that other half of the carbon, just from a mass balance point of view, does right now go up the stack. We're looking at, this is a vexing problem that will be solved over time, is that CO2 to capture that and then to have some sort of beneficial reuse of it that economically makes sense. Is there's a lot of other companies looking at this problem too, a lot of startups focused on this space. It can be captured. One of the problems that we run into is that there's not really a beneficial reuse that keeps it out of going right back up into the atmosphere, whether you sell it to an Air Liquide or a brewery, or it still goes right back up. A lot of innovative stuff being done around putting it into concrete and building materials such as that. But we sequester half of the carbon that comes in, and the other half is used to generate electricity.
Yeah, understood. And I'm pleased that I was able to offer you a vexing question here.
We're looking for a solution.
Yeah. So, looking at it a little differently, you're burning a carbon product that's already on the surface of the earth. That is significantly different than digging up carbon and burning it.
It is. Yeah. So there's two ways of looking at this. And a bunch of us on Mino, I'm one of them. We're ex-oil and gas people. We're deeply committed to climate warriors here and trying to fix the problem. But essentially oil and gas, you're transferring what has been locked up in the earth's crust for millions of years into the atmosphere. It's a one-way ticket up there. There's the view that biomass is basically carbon neutral because it's a cycle. The trees draw it down and then they rot. So part of where we're interacting with that cycle is we take half of that carbon that would go back up, and half of what comes into us does go up for generating the electricity, but the other half of it stays almost permanently in the soil via biochar. And then that also accelerates drawdown on the downstream side of it by increasing crop productivity.
Yep. Understood. So I grew up in logging country. I grew up in Southern Oregon. In fact, we lived and died by the logging industry down there. So I'm very familiar with the whole idea of slash. I mean, I've seen decimated forests all over the place. In a certain sense, it's just horrifying. So one of the things I'm wondering about, that slash is out in the wilderness someplace. So how do you get that raw material and start processing it?
It is, yeah. So it's interesting. Early days on the business model workup, we looked at having a smaller, more remote type of operation to go into the forests and interact with the slash. But we settled on a centralized approach because we just get these benefits of scale and the ability to generate electricity. We couldn't do that in the forest. But so how it does come out is when timber companies log, the tree farmers, when they log acreage, those limbs get left behind and they're basically stacked in those slash piles you see. But if there was a use for those limbs, it's the right time for the timber companies to just take them out with them. And that is their desire. We've had many discussions with a lot of the tree farmers, and the stacking and burning has just been a means to an end over 100 years of doing this. it takes up 2% as a general number of the acreage, those slash piles. So that cuts down on yield and productivity when you replant. And then the emissions that come off of burning those and the wildfire risk is getting to be more and more of a pain point. So it's operationally the easiest time for them to just get them out when they log an area. If there was somewhere that they could take them to, enter Mino.
Yeah, right. So is it possible or even likely that that process for the tree farmers could have a profit associated with it?
It could. Yeah, we're happy to pay for feedstock. That's absolutely in the business model here. So we're very keen to get that out. And there's, you know, we'll go right at it. There's a lot of carbon benefits that can be monetized over the course of doing this, and we see that as something to share with suppliers along the way. So we definitely do have a big tent view of this thing. It's a huge opportunity, and it's going to take a lot of people working together to solve it.
So what happens, this centralized facility you're talking about? So what's it look like, and what's the process there?
Yeah, so essentially what it'll be is when a lot of these slash piles have come out of the woods, what makes most sense is to chip them on location, because then you can just get more volume in a chip van. So chip them there, they'll be hauled into our facility, and then we'll run them through a drying circuit, essentially, to get them to the moisture content that we need to go into the pyrolysis chamber. And then once in there, then it's the high heat, it's the lack of oxygen, and there's residence time, and the pie gas is used to generate electricity, and then biochar comes out the other end. But it's a pretty simple operation for the most part, of, you know, wood chips coming into pyrolysis, a steam-powered boiler making electricity connected to a substation, and then biochar coming out and being sent to market. So, another thing we like about it is it's not a lot of, some people look for the software app that's going to solve climate change. We're not that. I hope that comes along and can magically do it, but, you know, we're very much a natural climate solution. So it's harnessing what Mother Nature does quite well for us here.
So that facility, what's the footprint of it? How big a building or whatever are we talking about?
Yeah, so roughly taking about 200,000 dry tons per year of feedstock is about a 30-acre footprint of just everything, for just trucks and the room you need for moving stuff around, is just kind of rule of thumb of what those ratios look like. And that winds up generating about 20 megawatts of power, which we think is also another really, you know, good thing in a lot of these communities. They're kind of the far-flung parts of Bonneville's grid, to be able to, you know, minimize the power Bonneville's got to push up to them, and just have a local baseload source of power. It's 24/7 operation, so we'll complement the intermittency of renewables quite well.
So you made a comment, I think, that this is not new technology. I mean, I've done a little background myself, and it appears that there are some cultures that have been using this technology for a few thousand years. And so I'm wondering, is there stuff to be discovered yet? Are you guys, do you have a research component to what you're doing as well?
We do. Yeah. You know, two things there. Yeah. It's been, I think it really started in the Amazon, these terra preta soils, you know, thousands of years ago, that are still just, you know, remarkably fertile to the day. So, you know, pretty established technology. That said, though, we are doing a good bit of R&D for various biochar applications. For instance, our three big biochar markets are really water filtration, soil to get it into the dirt for forestry and agriculture, and then also for feed for dairy and poultry and such. Really cuts down on methane emissions from that part of the agribusiness sector. But each of those three does have, you know, subtly different characteristics about the biochar that make it perform more optimally in those segments. So that's something that's, you know, size, its residence time, its temperature, it's these sort of things to give it the properties that you want. So it's kind of early days on that, but as this becomes more and more of a ingrained solution, which we believe is inevitable, there will be a lot of refinements around various types of chars for various types of applications. Those are just the three that we're focused on now, and there will no doubt be others.
Yeah. So, what's the status? Do you have is this centralized facility in existence at this point?
No, we're going through. The first one is going to be out on the Olympic Peninsula here in Washington State. And we're completing our engineering on it. we're entirely self-funded. We've been doing this all ourselves, paying for it. The big facility is going to be close to $100 million. We don't have that kind of money. So we're starting the process of going out for a big raise for it. But one of the things that's kind of right place, right time, in good ways and bad, just with the way the climate is changing and awareness is coming of this, there's a lot of capital out there looking to help solve the problem. So it's one of the unique things about our mission is, you know, we want to do big, huge projects that matter, skip a bunch of steps here.
So not holding you to anything specific here, but what approximately do you think is the timeline when you might actually be in commercial operation?
2 years. Yeah.
Well, that's fast. I mean, you guys are taking an aggressive approach to this.
Yeah, we have, we've done, the engineering is pretty much there. We're, we got our site pretty well locked up and feedstock agreements in place, and then offtake agreements for the power purchase agreement have come together pretty quickly for us. So we're at the finishing stages of those three big parts of the project finance of, location, feedstock, and then offtake. So with those pretty well buttoned up, the project then becomes eminently financeable. Yes, it's a large number, but there's large returns in this also. To the joke about this time being different, one of the things that really makes this possible is the ability to monetize these carbon attributes, the carbon credits, the clean fuel standards, these things that come with the project also.
So just out of curiosity, you're here in Washington State. I'm talking to you from Tacoma. And so what kind of regulatory hurdles have you encountered as you're moving along and planning here?
We haven't really, no hurdles. We haven't got any special treatment, nor should we, but we very much have the view that, we want to do this right. And we've engaged early with the appropriate regulatory agencies on what we're doing. And, this will sound self-serving to say, but it's true. Our focus has really been, it's on climate, it's on environmental performance. It's all these things that are just naturally aligned with what the regulations are trying to cause to happen. So it's been pretty well received. Again, we're, going right through the steps, properly, but we do feel we're trying to do exactly what these regulations are meant to cause to happen.
Well, so that's good to hear. What about just like community pushback, like not in my backyard kind of thing?
We haven't had that. We've had just nothing but community support on it. One of the things about this is going to generate a lot of good jobs also in a lot of these communities. And we look at this as kind of three pieces to the puzzle to really succeed and to really see this be a worldwide solution, whether it's, it's not going to be us doing all of them. We'll do enough and we'll do fine. But hopefully we, inspire others to copy us. But it's got to do three things. Investors got to make a great return. There's got to be good jobs that the community will support it, that people can raise a family on. And then the third big piece of it is that the operations, our emission profile has to be carbon negative. That's the inflection point in society, is that growth and jobs, you just can't rely on spewing unfettered emissions into the atmosphere. So if you have growth and jobs and good returns while sequestering carbon, that's the future. As Wayne Gretzky put it, that's where the puck's going. That's where we should be skating to. So it's right what we're trying to do.
Yeah, so I'm just sort of wondering if some of those logger families that have been struggling for so many years out there in the Olympic Peninsula might start thinking of the environment a little differently if they were getting jobs from environmentally protective things.
It's a key part of the selling pitch on it, and it should absolutely be a part of the overall package on what we're doing out there. Is, good job. There will be a lot of jobs. This will be, to us, not being the software app that's going to solve the problem. This is going to be people, rolling up the sleeves and working and, doing, traditional forest work, and just a little bit different bent on it here.
So you've mentioned soil several times. So how does this play into the soil thing? What's going on there?
Yeah. So it's, so biochar itself does not really do anything for the soil, but what it does is it really, it turbocharges basically the symbiotic microbiome within the soil. It allows the fungi in the soil to really thrive and grow faster. And that's ultimately the motor of what draws down carbon, accelerates plant productivity, and then stores it in the soil. Great movie, if any of the listeners have it, Kiss the Ground. It's all about this in soil. And soil is going to be a big part of the solution for climate. All of the 2 trillion tons of excess carbon dioxide that we have in the atmosphere, that can all be put in the soil very easily through this.
Well, that's certainly a hope that I would have that that we can do that. And that, so we're doing two things at the same time. We're getting the carbon out of the atmosphere and we're putting it in the ground where it's doing some good.
Exactly. Yeah, that's just the symbiotic benefits of this. You know, we think that we really get the virtuous cycle kicked off with this. And it's we love it, this part of the business, that it really has materiality to it. This can be a big solution, big part of the solution for the climate problem.
So you use the phrase carbon negative. So go over the math, for lack of a better term, of how this is carbon negative.
Sure. Yeah, no, great. So you burn diesel, puts carbon in the atmosphere for... The solar panel generates it with basically carbon zero. It doesn't burn anything, doesn't draw anything. We are carbon negative in that half of the carbon that comes in that wood feedstock goes into the biochar. And then the other part is they do these life cycle analyses, these LCAs, to map the carbon signature. And it'll be regulatory agencies doing this, not us, but we're looking at our own numbers to know that where we are on it. Is the avoidance from burning these slash piles and the emissions that come off of that all counts into, they look at it as kind of the counterfactual of what would have happened had this thing not existed, and then what is that net difference? So there will be a reduced amount of emissions over the status quo had we not existed. And that's generally what drives that carbon negativity. And the number, you can kind of work out what that is, but structurally, that's where the term really arises from, that we've generated electricity by in the process reduced carbon emissions.
Yeah, so I think part of the point you made there is that looking at any process in terms of carbon neutrality or negativity, you have to look at the entire process. And so one of the questions that popped up in my mind, I wasn't going to ask you, but now I'm going to ask you. So yeah. Is in that formulation, are you paying attention to the carbon emissions in transferring the materials from the forest to the centralized facility?
We are. Yep. We get docked for the diesel emissions and the trucks hauling, and as we should, on that life cycle analyses on it. And then, what CO2 goes up our stack from generating the electricity, we get docked on that also. So, basically it's just a big accounting exercise, and the best sense of it is, beginning to end, what's the net result of these operations.
Okay. It sounds like you're committed to paying attention to the pluses as well as the minuses on that formula.
Yeah. And we're always looking for ways, to our mission statement of, we want to remove as much as we can, as fast as we can. And we're always, that guides our internal debates and discussions. And we're always looking for ways to optimize the carbon performance. We have the basic view. This is our central bet with the company, that if we do right by carbon, economics is going to take care of itself, this time being different. Optimize the carbon performance and the returns are going to be there.
So part of my vision for you is that those trucks that are coming down out of the mountains are electrically powered sometime in the future and not running off of diesel.
Oh, I love it. I can't wait. And it will be here before we know it. I'm the optimist, but I have no doubt that's a lot of work being done on that also.
Yep. So let's talk about, it's a big earth, and let's talk about scalability a little bit. So how scalable is this? What's the upper limit of the scale on this concept?
Yeah. So we're focused on just woody biomass as a startup, focus, do one thing, do it well. We've got enough complexity in our stuff in it. But so woody biomass feedstocks are what we're focused on. If you broaden that out into agricultural waste and other things, we're just not really looking at right now. But Washington State itself could remove about 35 million tons of CO2 equivalents every year. If you scale that up worldwide, and I know this isn't going to happen tomorrow, but worldwide, if these things magically appeared everywhere, you could be removing 50 billion tons a year from a worldwide basis. And that, incidentally, is the net global emissions of the world economy right now. It's about 50 billion a year. We put 2 mm-hmm. trillion up. We put another 50 billion up every year. So,
right.
Tomorrow, if they magically appeared everywhere, you could be at net zero across the economy. And then if we just stop burning so much to make things move, we could enter a drawdown phase in the economy. So it's really real materiality and scalability to it. And the fact that it generates jobs, I know a lot of investors don't like things that
generate jobs. but it's just, it's going to be a big part of the solution, you know, unless somebody gets that magic software app that does it. And, you know, I hope they do, but this is the here and now, and no sense waiting. We can get on with it.
Yeah. So I'm just sort of smiling to myself a little bit about the jobs issue, because every time there's some political flap that involves a corporation, they start talking about jobs. And at the same time they're talking about those jobs, they've got a team back at headquarters with spreadsheets trying to figure out how to get rid of jobs. So.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, we had a great phrase in the oil business. You need to have your social license to operate. You know, you lose that, you're toast. And that social license to operate, you know, jobs are going to be a big part of that, as it should be in these communities.
So you're doing a great job in terms of what a CEO would be like in terms of explaining your company and the benefits, the promise of it. Are there things that concern you, things that worry you, things that could be potential roadblocks?
We're trying to do a massive project. I mean, no sense sugarcoating it. This is a big, you know, $100 million, you know, project right out of the gates. You know, there's a lot of interest in it. A lot of people wanting to fund this thing. A lot of people saying all the right things. One of the things that concerns me most about it is you see this with a lot of the large asset managers that, you know, proxy holding, you know, shares in companies, and they all say the right thing about climate, but then when they vote on shareholder initiatives, they don't vote the right way. So there's, I think that we still have a ways to go on public conviction, if you will, around this issue, to transition from saying the right thing to doing the right thing. And that's just kind of more my biggest concern out in society, of when if everybody gets on board with doing the right thing, you know, we'll whip this problem.
Right.
You know, it's just how quick do we get there? And, yeah. And I see that a lot in our, you know, efforts to date. That dichotomy has become very clear to me.
Yeah, I think you're right on target there, that really the only barriers towards a clean energy future are political and cultural. They're, otherwise, we could just do it.
It is, right? Everybody's doing the easy, everyone, you know, do what I say, not what I do. You know, unfortunately, there's a bit of that, you know, it's still going on, but we're going to transition through that. I have no doubt. Ever the optimist, we'll rise to it and get on with this. And we're going through that of, we're just seeing more and more people, you know, big companies, investors willing to put their money where their mouth is. So, you know, it's a small but growing percentage of it.
Whereabouts in the Olympic Peninsula is your site?
Yeah. So we're looking, I can't say yet.
Okay.
We do have it, but it's, you know, a couple of NDAs with some project partners on it. But what I can say is we're planning many of these. All, you know, without naming who's going first, you know, we're looking at the big wood baskets, you know, up north of the park, Port Angeles area, Mason County down near Shelton, you know, Aberdeen's a big wood basket out there. Longview down south, we really want to get out to Clay Alum, and we get a lot of good pull from communities and just, you know, stakeholders and policy people we talked to, with just with the wildfire risk on that side of the Cascades. We'd like to get out, so we want to have, you know, many of these are around the state, but we are 2 years away from our first one, and we'll have everything when we get these agreements all finally buttoned up. We'll be much more public about it.
Well, I'm glad I asked you that question, because when I was thinking about the whole concept, you know, that's a lot of slash in the state of Washington. Just the state of Washington is a long ways from the Olympic Peninsula. So to have the facilities closer to the natural resource seems to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, we look at it in that there's, you know, there's a natural economic radius around the movement of feedstock in these areas, and that kind of governs location and facility size, you know, et cetera. But, you know, you get down to, it gets to be a feedstock game at the end of the day on how to plan and optimize these things.
Well, it's an exciting concept. I've developed some understanding of it I didn't have before. We're about out of time, Thor. Anything else you'd like to add before we finish up here?
No, just, you know, hey, if there's a listener out there that's got $100 million in the back pocket, ring me up. I'd love to hear from you. So, special deal. No,
okay.
No, I joke, but it's been great. And I mean, I do feel that, you know, society, I think, is, you know, transitioning quickly from, you know, saying the right things to more quickly doing the right thing. So we and society and the planet will get there.
Well, fingers crossed. Let's put it that way. That's my perspective. Fingers crossed. So I've really enjoyed talking with you, Thor, and I appreciate you taking the time. And I would like to put a placeholder, maybe a year out, and see how things are going. If you'd be open to that,
let's do it. No, yeah, love to come back on and keep you and your listeners updated on our progress. You know, really grateful for the opportunity here.
Okay, excellent. So thanks again. Take care.
Okay, thank you, John.
So thanks for listening. I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at John, that's J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. I am an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby here in Tacoma. It's a good outfit. Check it out. Most of all, be active with folks who are working to create a viable future for us, our children, and for generations to come. As a reminder, that this program and all other locally produced KTAH programs are available on the KTAH website. Just do an internet search for KTAH. You'll find this program and other climate talks in the archive under programming. While you're there, check out my 60-second Climate Minute archive also. I think you'll get a kick out of it. So that's it for today, and I'm reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.